On the show today, Luc Robitaille from Hull, play for Olympique. Okay, welcome once again to something that's becoming more of a weekly occurrence than a special. So, Elliot Friedman, I fall short of calling it a special. This is a blank edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Bonus edition, I suppose.
Well, it is Christmas. It's the Christmas season, so maybe it's a Christmas special.
We are in the spirit of giving. So this week
we're post-Hanukkah pre-Christmas special.
Giving you the gift of Luc Robitaille. Now, Luc Robitaille, as we record this podcast right now on Wednesday, now last Wednesday, was in town for the second edition of the Canadian Expat Summit at the Toronto Global Forum. This brings together 50 Canadian expat leaders from four different continents to share their expertise with attendees, including post-secondary students. Essentially, it's a way of expats talking to people that still live in Canada, generally younger people, and talk to them about the opportunities provided in other countries. That's why Luc Robitaille was in town today, and we had a chance to sit down for close to an hour with Luc.
Couple of things. He spoke right after Doug Ford, and I'm trying to imagine a bigger juxtaposition of two people between Doug Ford and Luc Robitaille.
Here's what I always say, Elliot.
What's
as
that?
An aside, you know what your job is at the end of the day? The end of every single day. You know what your job is, Elliot?
Keep breathing?
Yes, stay alive. Because if you stay alive, you will see some very, very weird things in this world. You never know. They're just around the corner. Did you ever think that you would say that sentence? Luc was speaking right after Doug Ford. But there it was.
Doug Ford and Luc Robitaille, Canadian Expat Summit.
Puppet Show and Spinal Tap. I told them. Spinal Tap and Puppet. Okay, go ahead.
That's a great reference, by the way.
Thank you. So they were speaking today, and we had a chance to sit down in a private room at the Royal York Hotel in downtown Toronto to talk to Luc Robitaille. And one of the interesting names, we talked to him a lot about certainly his career with the Los Angeles Kings, Stanley Cup with the Detroit Red Wings, playing junior hockey as well. And one of the names that he mentions in here is someone who never played in the NHL, although he was a dynamic junior hockey player. And all junior hockey fans, especially in the queue, know the name Guy Rouleau. Now, Guy Rouleau was someone that was smallish, great scorer at the junior level, but was in that era where, you know, your 5'8 guys aren't going to make it to the NHL. And he was never drafted into the National Hockey League, nor did he ever play. But he speaks glowingly about what Guy Rouleau was able to teach him about goal scoring. And for those that are interested, Guy passed in 2008 from, I believe, brain cancer. I saw him play RHI. As you all know, Elliot is a big fan of Roller Hockey International. He played on Montreal and Ottawa, so I got a chance to watch him there. But he'll hear the reference, Guy Rouleau. He's a legendary scorer in the queue.
1985-86 Hull Olympiques, 61 games, 91 goals, 100 assists, 191 points, 70 penalty minutes. Then in the playoffs,
okay,
15 games, 23 goals, 20 assists, 43 points. Memorial Cup,
yeah,
5 games, 7 goals,
yeah,
9 assists, 16 points, which tied the record for points in the Memorial Cup at the time.
Amazing. So he was a remarkable player, and sitting on the shoulders of greatness, you know, we always sit on the shoulders of those that came before us. It sounds like very much Guy Rouleau was a prime mover in the career of a young Luc Robitaille. What interested you the most going into this interview, Elliot?
I've always admired the way Robitaille carries himself. It's hard to tell sometimes if he's having a bad day. Now, I don't see him as much as other people see him, and I'm sure people who know him better than I do will laugh hearing that. But at least publicly, he always puts on a really good face. He smiles a lot, and he's got a lot to like. I mean, he had a great career. He's in the Hall of Fame. He won a Stanley Cup as a player. He's got two as an executive. There's a lot to like about everything he's done. But I've met people who are very successful and can still be incredibly grumpy. Mm-hmm. He's not like that. I've always admired the way he's kind of carried himself, especially since he was a real long shot.
Complete long shot. Ninth round draft pick, 1984, the Mario Lemieux draft. There's a lot of great late picks in that one. Gary Suter goes in the ninth round as well to the Calgary Flames. I want to say Brett Hull went in the sixth round at that point. So there was Tom Glavin was selected,
yes.
Legendary,
he
of course, baseball player.
Before he was.
Which is always a great story. But Robitaille goes down in history as, you know, one of the great left wingers, and even, you know, to his own admission, and you'll hear this in the interview as well, is pretty upfront about the fact that, hey, listen, I was never a great skater. You know, I was never a burner. To that end, you probably couldn't see Luke Robitaille, as skilled as he was, great vision, super hands, you couldn't see him really succeeding in a league like this, other than the fact that he was just, I think in a lot of ways, Elliot, smarter than a lot of guys that he was on the ice with.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a determination and a will that was not going to be broken. That's Luke Robitaille, the player. So without further ado, we're going to present Luke Robitaille here on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Do want to let you know, however, Luke was on a lav. So that's one of the microphones that you clip on your shirt. Elliot and I had stick mics, and we were close to a radio tower. So if anything bothers you, that's why. Here's our conversation. Luke Robitaille on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Brought to you by the GMC Terrain.
First overall by the Pittsburgh Penguins. Our next inductee was selected by the LA Kings 169 picks later. Despite being such a late selection, he would go on to win the Calder. He would set a new mark for goals and points in a single season by a left winger. He scored 40 or more goals for 8 straight seasons. He even managed to become teammates with every other player in the Hall of Fame class of 2009. He would win his Stanley Cup as a member of the Red Wings in 2002. Along the way, the 170th pick in the 1984 draft became and still remains the highest scoring left winger in the history of the game. Ladies and gentlemen, Luke Robitaille.
Tied at 2, Robitaille's in front alone, he's got it, but he fell down, he backs it, he scores! What a goal! The Kings win! Robitaille fell down and won on his stomach, swept it into the net. The Kings win in overtime. They beat Detroit 3-2.
I've seen it too many times before to call him lucky. That's his nickname. But Luke Robitaille initially looked like he was going to run out of time. When he felt he couldn't get a shot, he said, I'm going to spin and get the backhand. While spinning, he went down. And it didn't stop him on the spin. It's in Luke Robitaille. Let's start that again. In lucky Luke Robitaille fashion, the sense for the net is outstanding. When you score 500 in this league, you get some ugly ones and you get some pretty ones. And there's a pretty one there by Luke Robitaille.
Pleased to be joined now on 31 Thoughts, the podcast, by the president of the Los Angeles Kings, Hall of Fame member, and one of the greatest left wingers the game has ever seen, the one and only Luke Robitaille joins me and Elliot here on the 31 Thoughts podcast. You're here in Toronto for the Canadian Expat Summit. You travel around, you do a number of different events. I'm curious, Luke, at this point in your capacity, how much time do you get to actually watch hockey?
I've been watching a lot of hockey the last few months. I don't do too many of those events. I mean, there's no time, you know. But I would say my wife, it was kind of funny this year, she said, well, the season's starting. I go, yeah. She says, I'm going to go to India and do a trip and do this. She did this whole spiritual journey. I'm like, man, you're going to be gone a long time. She goes, doesn't matter. I won't see you for the next month. So she was right.
So how did that go? Like, how did her trip go?
It was great.
Yeah.
It was great. She went to Bhutan. Mm-hmm. She went to India. She did a thing with the Dalai Lama, like a week with him. And then she did this thing where it's like a whole silence meditation for 2 weeks. Where they don't speak, no phone, nothing. She asked me, would you do that with me? I said, no, I'm not ready.
Is there any chance you could? What's the longest you could be quiet? What's the longest you could allow yourself to speak?
Probably do a couple of days.
Because it would seem like a real luxury at this point, considering we're always on our phones, we're always communicating.
Yeah.
It's the nature of the business. Yeah. Just to be able to leave it all.
Like we did this thing last summer where we walked. It's called a Camino de Santiago, where you just... Basically, you just walk, you know, and it was very interesting because when you're walking, you got your sticks and, you know, we walk, I think, a couple hundred miles in about 10 days. it was very interesting because it's totally different than our world. You know, you're so focused. And all you had to focus is on the next step. You can't even have a goal because you're going to be, oh, it's too far. I'm not doing it today. So it was an interesting part of my life. I'd never done anything like that.
Julian Brisbois, well, I don't know if he still does it now, but I heard him once say that his family, at dinner time, they have an hour where they put everything away. Nobody's allowed to have a phone or a computer or anything like that. And I said, what if something happens? And he said, well, at the time, they know where to reach me. They can always call me at home. I've tried that.
Yeah.
I have mixed success. Yeah. Like, there's times I can get through it. There's other times I've got no chance. Am I going an hour today?
Isn't that funny? Our world has changed.
It's depressing.
I always joke, like, how did they do business in the 50s?
I know. Well, and it's funny because that concept, that's essentially Sunday dinner where, I mean, and it wasn't, we're not that far removed from that culture where the whole family gets together, both immediate and extended family, and everybody sits together and you catch up on the week and you talk about things that aren't just business related. And you're right. It's a challenge now because, listen, as you well know in your role as president of the Los Angeles Kings, that's not a 9-to-5. That's not a punch the clock. That's on the job 24 hours.
You're always on, yeah. It is kind of interesting, our life. How, and then you see these kids now, they could be sitting together, and none of them are talking to each other. But yeah. They're texting each other stuff. It just always blows my mind.
They're not talking, but they write.
Yeah.
So I want to take you back. Kelly Rudy was a teammate of yours, yeah. And one of the things he's talked about was that, you have said in the past, how you really beat the odds. You were not a guy who was expected to be a star at the level you were in the NHL. I want to take you back to 1984 before you're drafted. You're scoring a ton in the Quebec League, but all these people are doubting you. Did you ever doubt that this could happen?
My first year junior, I had an okay year, but we had a terrible team. And Mario happened to be playing 2 hours away in Laval. So no one saw our games, and I'm always grateful that this one scout, Alex Smart was his name. He lived in Ottawa, and he attended every one of our games. And I think he's the only one that scouted. I know for a fact now that no one ever even looked at me. And I think he saw that I loved the game. I think he just saw that, because we had a terrible team, so I had to battle every day. I mean, it was not a good situation my first year in junior. And he's the one. I know he's the only one that tried to talk to me that year. He's the only one that pushed to draft me, even with the Kings organization. And I never asked Woge. I don't think he would remember. But I think it was in the eighth round, because there was the only team that had talked to me. So I always thought, Ellie's going to draft me because he talked to me. You don't know that how things are going on as a kid, And in the eighth round, Woge went on a stage and he went to announce, he says, on the eighth round, in Rogi Vachon, the LA Kings wants to draft. And he said, look, but he did say it in French, look. And then someone kind of looked at him from the table, the Kings table, and they said something. He went out. Then he went back and he drafted another guy. And the guy I knew was Shannon Deegan. So I was like, I could have gone out in the eighth round,
God.
I did believe that. Then in the ninth round, he came and he drafted my name right then and there.
And that was, of course, the Montreal Forum. That's the Mario Lemieux draft 1984. Yeah. And the story that I was told.
Hold on a second. That must have been the worst 30 minutes of your life. Because after you hear your name.
I'm not sure, but he did say Luke. He said Luke. And I was like,
yeah. It's got to be me.
They talked to me. There was no Luke after that.
As the story goes, now, the guys get the jersey and the hat and all that. What was your story going down from the stands? Did you make it onto the floor? Did you make it to the table?
I was in the whites. Remember Montreal Forum was red, white, and the blue. So I was in the whites, maybe one row above, because I didn't know where to sit. I was with my dad. I didn't have an agent. So when I heard my name, I ran down, and I went to get on the ice, and there was a policeman there, and he wouldn't let me get on the floor. And Pierre Lacroix happened to walk by. He was an agent. And I'm not sure I had met him at that point. I met him, I think, the next summer. But he recognized me. He goes, hey, look. He goes, congratulations. He knew he was coming. I don't know where he was coming from. I guess agents were on the floor then.
Yep.
And he told the cops, he goes, it's okay. This kid just got drafted by the Kings. So he let me on, and I'm walking. I'm looking at the Kings logo on the table. I get to the Kings table, and I think they want a break because there was no one there. It was one guy. At the time, it was the assistant GM, and his name was John Wolfe. And And I met him. He goes, yeah, can I help you? It would be like a table like this, but he's alone. So I'm like, I'm Luke Robitaille. He goes, and he really doesn't know. He's just right. He goes, I go, you just drafted me, but I can barely speak English. And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, and he's just a nice man. He goes, congratulations. And he looks at me. He goes, and he looked, there was a box underneath the table. And he goes, ah, I don't have any hats. I don't have anything. He goes, I'm so sorry. But he goes like this, just out of nowhere. He goes, here, I have a pin. He goes, congratulations.
He grabbed it off his lapel.
He gives me his pin right out of his, I have it. I put it in my office last year. Found it back in my dad. I don't know why he kept it in a cup in some
awesome.
Place, but
that's
I found
awesome.
It. Yeah.
You've always had a great attitude. Like, you're Lucky Luke, smiling. You've always been a very positive guy. Did you ever feel, I don't know, if slighted is the right word, like mistreated, like on that day or anything like that?
No. I mean, you know, y'all, everybody wants to come on the first round, but I think I thought in my mind, I'm going to come on the third round. I really didn't happen. And then I remember kept going. I think in those days, I mean, it's like Pittsburgh didn't know Mario wasn't going to go. And I don't know if you remember, it took almost like a half hour after. Yeah. It was forever. I think my name came out at like 6 o'clock that night. Started at 1, but my thing is, the minute I heard my name, I remember clearly thinking, my name's on the list. Now it's up to me. I wasn't like, oh, Sunday night. I didn't care. Like, it was my name. Like, I was hoping I'd come on the third round, but I didn't. And now I'm like, okay, my name's on the list. It's up to me. I remember clearly thinking that.
That was a really interesting time for you, an interesting time for the Los Angeles Kings. You walk into a Los Angeles Kings dressing room, and there's you, and there's Jimmy Carson's young hockey players, and there's Marcel Dion, who still, I don't think, gets talked about enough as being one of the greats of all time, along with players like Gilbert Perreault, one of the greats to unfortunately never win the Stanley Cup. But Dion is, as you all know, Luke, just spectacular. What was it like walking into that room and playing with Marcel Dion, the legend?
It was kind of funny because my first camp, you know, I was so nervous to meet him. But, you know, growing up in Montreal, we knew the Canadians. You know, we saw Toronto, we saw Montreal, and then we never really saw the Kings, you know. But I had heard Marcel Dion, and I had heard this Triple Crown line. Yeah. But coming in, he seemed so old, you know. Like, in those days, you're coming in, he seemed so old. And guys used to come to camp to get in shape, so it was different, you know, that era. And I was always trying to figure out my odds. You know, I was like, I remember thinking, well, these guys get to camp to get in shape, so I'm going to make sure I'm in really good shape when I get to camp so I can have an edge. Like, I had the old saying that I had heard later, that, oh, you can't go faster than a veteran, you can't do that. I was like, I didn't care. I was like, if I get beat up because I go faster than them, I don't care, even though they said I was slow. So whenever we'd do skating drills, this Pat Quinn was our coach. Like, he did all the blue to blue. All the guys would stop, or, you know, goal line to goal line. They'd stop skating the blue line. I would just keep going. Because my thinking was, I got to finish first. So if there's a scout looking at me, they'll say, well, he's first. And so everything I did was in that way. Like, you know, like, so for me to see Marcel, I was enamored. I'm like, oh, I could beat him. I could beat him at camp because he's out of shape. That's the way I thought, you know. But he was great. He really took care of us. But the first couple of years, he was nice. The third year when I came and Jimmy Carson, Steve Duchesne was there, he took us under his wing. He literally made sure that we were taken care of.
When was the moment, Luke, where you said to yourself, I'm here to stay. I'm going to make it.
My last year junior, I won Player of Canada. So I knew right then and there, like, I'm like, okay, now they're going to treat me like a first, because I didn't really know the system. Because my first camp, I think I did three scrimmages and scored 6 goals. I thought I made the team. Like, I'm going to make the team. They cut me right away. The next year, I come to camp, and I scored again. And I'm like, there's no way they're not keeping me. I did only three scrimmages. The first cut, they cut me again. I was so disappointed because I'm like, I think my first scrimmage, I had 3 goals. Bernie Nichols asked to play with me because he liked it. He was like, this kid scores every time he touched the ball. I thought I was going to make the team. But every time I went back, I'm like, okay, I'll try to show them that they're wrong. So the third year, I thought I had a really good shot because I saw the first few years how I was a 9th-round pick. In those days, the budgets weren't the same. So they'd always give me, like, old equipment. First year, I didn't even have a pattern. They just gave me random sticks.
Wow.
You know, second year, I had old equipment. And then I get there, the third year, I had brand new gloves, brand new pants. I'm like, All right, now they're really looking at me this year. But I was ready. I was ready at that camp. I remember that.
Yeah, one of my favorite Luke Robitaille stories, I'm sure you've told this one before. If you're looking at images of Luke Robitaille playing, if he has white tape on his stick for the first and the third period, black in the second, where does that come from?
I played with this great goal scorer in junior, Girolo. First, he was the first guy. He's the guy that taught me how to take care of everything. He taped his stick every period. Mm-hmm. In junior, we didn't tape every period. We just played the whole game, you know. And he changed his laces like every couple weeks. And, you know, I started watching him and I learned a lot from him. He actually is the guy that taught me how to score goals because I love Gretzky so much. I wanted to be a playmaker. So I always pass. He was my center. He got 90, 92, or 94 goals, whatever. I got a lot of goals, but I got more assists because playing with him. But I remember after practice, he'd teach me. So I started taping my stick every period. And I think one game, it wasn't working. So in the second period, I just taped black. Mm-hmm. And I think something happened. I must have got a goal. Then the third, I went back to white. And I just did it my entire career. And no one ever mentioned it until way later. My entire career, I never veered from it. I did it my entire career.
And no one ever picked up?
No one ever picked up. Yeah, it's kind
of until now.
Until now, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And you had the reputation to it. Right now, David Pastrnak has the ugliest tape job in the NHL. Yeah. He just grabs it. It's like he closes his eye. And you were the same way?
Yeah. That's what I would do. I would tape it quick. And I kind of liked it when there was one or two spots open, actually. And guys, it would drive everybody nuts. But then they would see me work on my stick for hours. Like I'd work on shave it, make sure, because it had to be perfect on the ice. I had this whole thing. And when it was wood, I'd curve it. I'd work on it. Then I would tape it. And they'd be like, I can't believe you're taping it that way.
I like that you're one of those guys who does things on purpose to annoy other people. I like that. That's a good character trait. I like that. So you mentioned Gretzky. Where were you that day? Like, when did you hear?
I was in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bruce
and did you know it was coming?
Well, I'm going to tell you, like, the February before, when the All-Star game in St. Louis, Bruce McNall was the first year you had control of the team. And we're coming back on his plane to L.A., and he said, we're going to get Gretzky. I'm like, there's no way. We're not getting Wayne Gretzky. Plus, that was my idol. So I'm like, there's no way. But I'll never forget he told me that in St. Louis at the All-Star game. We were flying back. He told me, I think we were driving back to get on the plane. So then push to the summer. Wayne wins the cup. He's the best player in the world. And I think it was sometime in July I started hearing that they thought he was coming. And then he called me a couple days before. Mm-hmm. He said, I think he's coming. He goes, it won't be you, Luke. He goes, they want a young guy, but it won't be you. I promise you I won't trade you. And he did. He had promised Jimmy, myself, and Stevie wouldn't trade us. And I think what happened, I'm not sure exactly the story, but I think Jimmy, when he heard there was rumbling, or I think Bruce called Jimmy too. Jimmy was a smart guy. Like I always thought Jimmy was like a baseball player. He knows it hurts together. I don't go there. He was smart. And he was a great talent. And I think he was like, well, if Wayne comes here and Bernie Nichols here, I'll be a third line center. So I think he hinted to Bruce that it might be good for him to go because his ice time was going to be
cut.
Totally, you know, diluted. So the trade was going to happen no matter what. But that was, I know Glenn Sayre was fighting to get one of the young guys.
How many, I'm curious, well, you were playing with the Los Angeles Kings, even elsewhere, because there were various times where, Nordiques really want Robitaille. Nordiques really want Robitaille. Sakic goes the other way. Sakic and Gretzky up the gut for Los Angeles. How much would you have heard of, been aware, heard whispers about trades involving yourself?
Sometimes you heard it. I mean, when we came to, especially when I came to Quebec, and what I didn't realize then is, the reason a lot of time was part of rumors is I most of the time in L.A., I played the second line. So I was like the secondary scoring and everything. So I'm sure there was always like, well, maybe you could trade him and, you know, it'd be different. I mean, the only time I ever played on the first line in L.A. was in 92, 93 when Wayne was hurt. My center was Yeri. And so I think a lot of time that happens because of that, you know, but never knew. You know, you just... It didn't really bother me. I was going to play no matter what. And I felt very comfortable in L.A. I didn't think I was going anywhere.
Now, you've always liked California for a lot of reasons. That time when he was there and even more celebrities started showing up, Kelly said that there were some things he saw that, like, were absolutely crazy. Like, what is the craziest thing you can tell us that won't get us all fired?
Oh. Well, there was so many. Kelly's right. There was so many things. Like, you know, it never happened. It never happened before. It will never happen again. Bruce McNall would bring celebrity, like, right before the game. I remember we're sitting between warm-up and the game, and he brings Sylvester Stallone. And he goes, "Hey, guys, I brought Rocky to pump you up." And he goes, yo, come on. And, you know, he starts telling us, got to win. And we're all looking like, you know, you're going on the ice. I remember he leaves the room. We're like, he's really small. That's all we saw. He brought John Candy in Toronto literally right before the game, and he's telling us jokes. I mean, he brought, you know, I remember he brought, like, actresses. He brought, what was her name? Marlee Matlin. Mm-hmm. And she came in our locker room, and it was in Chicago. We thought she was a reporter. She had glasses. She was with Bruce, but I think she was holding something. We thought she was just a reporter, and then she saw Ron Duguay come out of the shower. She went like this. So we all laughed. We were like, oh, maybe that's not a reporter.
You know, you're that's a great story. You were drafted the same year as Brett Hull, so 84. And Brett Hull used to always want to ask about goal scoring. Brett Hull used to have a great saying, sometimes the best way to be in the play is to be out of it. Mm-hmm. He would find those quiet areas, set himself up for the one time on the quick shot, dined out on that for so many years. You, of course, one of the greatest goal scorers the game ever saw. How did you do it? Like, did you have a secret? Did you have something you always... I love Hull's, you know, be in the play by being out of it. What was it for you, Luke?
I mean, I wasn't as talented as Brett. Like, for me, like, I know I learned to shoot a one-timer my last year in junior because this guy, Girolo, taught me how to shoot it. It was hundreds of pucks. We'd break every stick we had because during that we'd have to leave. And then when I turned pro, I still thought of myself as a playmaker, but I got to play with Marcel. Like, we were on the third line. Like, Bernie was the first line. Jimmy Carson was Dave Taylor. Paquin made three lines. Mm-hmm. And Marcel said to me, he says, "Kid, if I give it to you, just put it, it's to put it in the net." He goes, "Don't worry, just go to the net, I'll find you." And so I knew enough to give it to him and let him make the play. Yeah. So I kind of adjusted to a lot of guys that I play with. It's then, because in junior I played the half wall on the power play, when we got Wayne, Robbie Fittark was our coach, he made me take Wayne on the power play. So I'm like, I'm never going to play. I'm taking Wayne on the change. I mean, the best player in the world should play 2 minutes on the power. So I would get on the ice. Next thing you know, that, see, I started a year and I'm like 10, 15 seconds on the ice on every power play. So I was like, so I had a few games where I didn't score, didn't produce, and somehow Rogi Vashon called me in his office and he's like, "Yeah, don't worry about it. I know it's going to come back. We're not worried." I see sometimes you get frustrated because, you know, you want to produce. And I look at him, I go, he goes, he asked me something about the power play. I go, "You know, I played the front of the net before." He goes, "You have?" I go, "Yeah." Because I knew if I played the front of the net, I could play with Wayne on the power play. So he looks at me, "Really?" So literally the next day, Tom Webster was our coach. Yeah, because Robbie Fittark the year before, that's what I was saying. It took a year for me. And Tom Webster was our coach, and Webby came to me, he goes, "You played the front of the net?" I go, "Oh, yeah." And I'm totally lying. Never played the front end my entire career. But I'm like, all right, if that's what it takes for me to be successful in the NHL, I'll go to the front. I wonder if I took a beating. And then the rest of my career, everybody said, "Oh, he's a front of the net guy." I just adjusted to what was there.
I want to fast forward now to Detroit. 2002, because you mentioned Brett Hull. You're on the same team. 10 Hall of Famers on that team. I mean, as crazy as it must have been with Gretzky in L.A., yeah, it must have been really something else in Detroit for different reasons.
Yeah, it's probably the greatest team put together that I'll ever. I mean, it's just truly. I mean, the Oilers are probably the early 80s. It's got as many Hall of Famers, I think, or close to. But it truly was amazing. Ken Holland put the right team. They had, obviously, a really good team. And what was great about the team is everybody was willing to put their egos aside. It's probably because we had accomplished so much. And a lot of us, like my last goal was to win the cup. You know, Brett wanted to win again. Stevie wanted to win again. And, you know, Shanning, these guys. So it was pretty special. Scotty was the right coach for it.
9 Stanley Cups. He shares a record with Toll Blake. Scotty says, don't ever compare me with Toll Blake. He was the very best. He won his 8 cups in just 13 seasons. Tonight is Scotty's 36th finals win, another record. I say to you, William Scott Bowman, take a bow, Scotty. Your numbers, they stand forever. I'll let them count you down to another Stanley Cup for Detroit, 2002. Yes, sir.
Lou Robitaille, first time. Now he can say he has touched the Stanley Cup because this is the first time in his life. He's had opportunities to walk up to it many times. The first time he has ever touched it, his wife's station.
Lou Robitaille, you said you never even wanted to touch the Stanley Cup before until you won it. You just touched it. What did it feel like?
There's no feeling like it. I mean, you work all your life, you know, playing a game you love, and to win it, I don't even know what to say.
There were a lot of sacrifices by you, by Stephen, by Jesse, by Stacia, weren't there, being away from your family?
Yeah, but it was worth it.
Scotty was the right coach for it because it was like, I remember in September he got mad at Dave Lewis and Barry Smith. They were our assistant coach. Scotty didn't even go on the ice the first week. He comes by the board and he gets mad at Dave Lewis in front of us. He goes, if I see anybody get hurt here, it's your fault. He said, I don't want to see anybody stop on the skating drills. And he goes, but... And we're all kind of laughing at Dave Lewis. We're like, yeah, we can't get hurt. But when he finishes sending, he goes, because we're playing till June. Then he walked away. I was like, huh. That was interesting. He started preparing us to play till June in September. Now, obviously, he knew he had a good team, but it was like he knew what he had to do to get us to do things during the year. Like every once in a while, he never talked, but every once in a while, if he'd say something, he'd be like, yeah, I figured. Ron, I'm winning the cup. You're not going to be able to do that stupid play. You know, now Scotty, he talks to you like, oh, yeah, okay, that's right. You know, he's. It was interesting. It was truly an incredible run just to be the favorite right from the get-go, finish first, get in the play. We went through ups and downs. I mean, we all knew the toughest team to beat was Colorado, and it was an amazing series, and it was an incredible experience.
You know, we had Andrew Ferentz on the podcast last week, and as much as a lot of his Oilers comments got most of the headlines. To me, one of the more interesting things that he talked about was the nature of winning, erasing regret. And he said, you know, we won as a Boston Bruin in 2011 against the Vancouver Canucks, but if he wouldn't have won with the Bruins then, you know, he wonders how much he would have lived with the regret of losing against the Tampa Bay Lightning when he played with the Calgary Flames. If you hadn't won the Stanley Cup with the Detroit Red Wings, how would you look back on your career?
I don't know, but certainly winning it capped it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you move on. This is something bigger in our life than just playing hockey and what we want to do, you know. But I know now that you never know what it takes to win until you win. You think you do. Every hockey player, every athlete is like, I want to win, especially in hockey, such a team sport. You want to play to win. You want to be successful, but you want to win, and every one of us play better when we want to win. But you really don't know what it takes to win until you win. And I think that's, for me, even after my after career, I take those lessons I learned in Detroit every single day with me.
What does it take then?
It takes everyone. Like when I was in Detroit and I got in Detroit, I could give you like a quick story. The LA Kings versus Detroit. So the year before we were in L.A., we had a good team. We beat Detroit, actually. And silly things. This is when nutrition started being kind of people were talking about. And we chipped in to buy shakes. You know, guys started doing the protein shakes post-game. So we went to the management and said, look, we're all buying shakes. You think the team would pay? And we kind of just asked. Like, and they said, no, we don't have a budget. So we said, okay. So all the guys, every month a different veteran would buy the shakes for the team. So the next year, I go to Detroit, and I get to Detroit, and it's about 2 weeks before camp, and we're skating, you know, and trainer comes to me, and he's got a notepad, and he says, you know, what's your workout routine? And I said, well, I like to do this post-game. I like to do this. He goes, is there any machine you need? I go, no, what you, you know, if you remember Detroit, the gym was right there.
Yep.
You guys got everything, and this is great. And then he asked me, he says, do you drink any protein shake? I go, oh, yeah. He goes, well, what brands? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I think at the time it was called EAS, you know.
Yeah.
What flavor? I'm like, flavor. I'm like, I don't know. I like vanilla and strawberry. So he writes him down, and he goes, all right, I'll have it tomorrow. I go, you're going to have, like, my own brand, you know, like, you know, my own flavor? He goes, well, yeah. He goes, yeah, don't worry. He goes, we just want to help you. He goes, you're here to help us win a cup. And he walks away. I'm like, huh. So then the next day I come in, and the little girl that worked for their foundation, like, you know, every team we sign autographs through time, you know, during the year, four or five times. And she says, same thing, just really nice. Had a little notepad. She says, you know, we do autograph session, we do these things. And I think they were doing stuff at the time where you'd sign your steaks and whatever, and they gave you a credit against a store. She says, all the guys like to sign them. We have the big signing. We do 3 a year. She goes, when do you like to do it? I'm like, I don't know. Well, no one, I make a joke. No one gave this. She goes, oh, no, we would never do that. But she says, some guys would rather do them before practice, after practice. Some guys don't want to do it the day before the game. So I'm like, well, I don't care. I says, whenever it's easier for you, if it's, as long as it's not on game day, I'm okay. And if you give me a couple days, I'll do it. And I go, thanks. She goes, no problem. She goes, we just want to help you. She says, we want to make your life as easy as possible, you know, so you can help us win a cup. And she walks away. I'm like, this whole thing of this entire organization was so ingrained on what their goal was. And everybody worked so that I go. And it was like these nice, kind gestures. But they kept reminding you that's what we're all in it for. And then when you win, you realize it's not just a team. It's not just the players. It's not just, it's everyone. You know, and it takes everyone to be successful. And that's why, you know, I think Detroit has had such success for so long. Because everybody was on board. It was, you know, it was really interesting for me to see and to live that.
And I would assume that that is a lot of what you try to incorporate now. Did you always see yourself as being a hockey business person after you were done?
Not really. I think when I retired and I had an opportunity to kind of work with AEG, our parent company, and Tim Leiwicki was there at the time, and he asked me what I wanted to do, and I wasn't sure. Then he said, maybe you can help us on different things that we're doing. I think at the time they had the arena in Kansas City, and, you know, there was rumor of Pittsburgh going there, if you remember. They were trying to negotiate, and you know, we talked a little bit, and I said, well, maybe I can be a consultant, and I could learn different sides. And he said, you want to be a GM, assistant GM? I said, I wasn't that interested. I said, here's what I said to him at the time. I said, you know, my whole career I took a lot of crap. I said, I listened to every coach. I was always respectful, and I was always the guy, well, he's too slow. They benched me a little bit. When they needed a goal, they played me. Then I took it. I took it because I was willing to pay the price to do it. So I said, I'm done with that. Now it's about me. This is the first time in my life it's really about me. So that was my thinking. So I said, so let me look into what's happening. But I didn't like our culture in LA. I didn't like the way we were seeing things because what I had learned in Detroit. So I kind of had an idea of maybe helping change that, but I didn't know to what level. So then I asked him when he said, you want to be a consultant? I said, yeah. So I'll come to the games, and I attended a few of Dean's meetings because I wanted to learn what was going on. Dean was great. And the two things I asked him, I go, can I have an office on your floor, which was downtown next to Staples Center, so I felt I could learn. And then the other thing, can I attend all the business meetings for the Kings and all that? And he said, yeah. But we're such a big company, we didn't have a lot of meetings for the Kings because it was all about a tennis, a soccer game, you know. Mm-hmm. So after a year, I just realized that we needed to build, like, our business the way an organization is built. Because if you buy a season ticket, let's say you're a fan of the Maple Leafs, you really don't care that MLSC owns the basketball team mm-hmm. or the soccer team. Mm-hmm. You care what they do for the Maple Leafs. Mm-hmm. It was the same for the Kings. Our fans were almost mad at our parent company because they felt they were focused on everything. No one was focused on the team itself. So I said, that's how it came about. So I'll be the one that's focused on the team. We'll make sure that whoever works for us is going to go to bed thinking about the Kings. When they wake up, they think about the Kings. Because if you're a season seat holder, that's all you care.
Mm-hmm.
You don't care about the other team. So that was kind of how we started changing that.
Now, you mentioned Dean Lombardi. I don't know if there are two people who would be more polar opposites as personalities than you and Dean Lombardi. And if Dean's listening to this, I'm not saying that to insult him.
No, I just understand.
He
would get a kick out of there that. Yeah, you're right.
You are as outgoing as they get. Yeah. Dean tries to be as private as possible. Yeah. You are constantly smiling. He's happy to be constantly growling.
Yeah.
What did you learn from him, and how did you guys mix as two very different people?
We all learn. I learn a ton from Dean because he came in, he had a very specific plan, and he wasn't going to let anyone influence him any way possible. And he stuck to it. I mean, it wasn't easy when we started. I mean, it's like, you know, it took a few more years than we thought, but he stuck to his plan. And it's funny, he likes to say, I'd love to, I hope he hears that. He likes to say, like, he is a mad scientist. He loves to shut the door and he'll put charts all over. But he is fun. You know, he's a good man. But if anything I learned, he had a plan. He stuck to his plan. And he didn't read all the, you know, everybody questions everyone when you go through these process. But he stuck to it. And, you know, he had a vision of the way he wanted the team to be and so forth. What he liked too is he knew, like, what we were doing. I never got in his way, but he knew what we were doing. Everything that we did on the business side had to match exactly what he was doing. So whether we listened to him when he was speaking to different people or him and I met, it had to match. I know that an organization only goes as the way hockey is. So everything that we did had to match exactly his vision. Like, I remember when we started, he was very specific about, if you're going to do an ad campaign, make sure there's four guys together, never one player. We're going to be a team here. So we always put four players on every billboard, you know, and everything. We picked the young kids, and it was very strategic on everything that we did. Mm. Yeah.
I remember Elliot mentioned Kelly Rudy earlier on in the interview, and I remember talking to Kelly once about when he played with the Kings. And he mentioned a conversation with Rogie Vachon, and he asked Rogie, you know, how often do you talk about, you know, different players on the team by way of trades? And Rogie said, I talk about every player every day. And Kelly told me he was kind of shocked at that. It's like, you know, you talk about me in trades. Well, we talk about everyone, or else we're not doing our job. And Kelly said he's pretty surprised at that. What has been the biggest surprise for Luc Robitaille as someone who works in management now? What was that eyes open wide moment for you?
Did anything really open my... I can't think of anything that was like shock. I mean, there's one thing is you cannot get emotional. And it's amazing to me how everyone gets so emotional over one game, one moment. And then, you know, and then if you start reading everything that's going, it's easy to get really emotional. But you really can't, you know, you have to stick to something and you have to believe it. And it's kind of funny because some guys will struggle for a while, but if you believe in them and they're the right player, so well, they turn it around. I mean, 2012, we barely got in the playoffs, you know, and next thing you know, we got the greatest run in the history of the game.
we were
unbeatable. I mean, I'd never seen a team play like that.
And now 34 seconds to go. This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone. The 45-year drought is over. The Los Angeles Kings are indeed the Kings of the National Hockey League. They are the 2012 Stanley Cup champions. The countdown is on. 3, 2, 1, it's over!
We saw that we were playing well, but I don't think any of us ever saw that we were going to be that dominant. I mean, you think of all the teams in the history of the NHL, the Montreal Canadiens and all, no one's ever won the playoffs with that easy. I mean, it's amazing, you know, so... I mean, if there's one thing I know is you got to stick to what you believe and you can't get emotional and you cannot make irrational decisions because they bite you back.
You've seen the highest of the highs as a player and executive, and this year you're seeing the reverse.
Yeah.
What's harder, losing as a player or losing as a president?
It's probably harder when you're on the business side, you know, as a president or managers, because, you know, there's so much you want to do, and then the patience comes into mind now, and having a goal and so forth. So it's harder, because when you're a player and you lose, you're like, ah, we'll get back tomorrow. You know, it's not fun when you lose a lot and you're out of it. But as a player, you're rewarded by that game if you play well, if things are starting to go good for you, because you're always fighting for something. And as a manager, it's from that standpoint, it's a little bit harder.
How does a season like this, as much as you can say, affect the Kings' business?
I think our fans understand where we're at. Like any fans, you know, you're not winning, you expect changes, you know, and they expect things out of us. But that being said, we're still okay, but we know things have to change. I mean, this is not the first year. We've only won one playoff game in the last 5 years, so we understand that we have to change as an organization. But that being said, we have our core of loyal fans that will always be there and support us, but we got to make sure that we do what's right for them too and fix where we're at. That being said, the way our game is today, you know, it's going to be real hard to keep it forever. And because when you have your run, at some point you got to make a few deals where you have to give up some draft picks and so forth. And we did it for a few years, and we took a run. It didn't work. And now we're finding ourselves that we have to make sure we hang on to everything, all the young guys that we have coming up. But I think the worst thing to be in our league is be a middle-of-the-pack team. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're in the middle of the pack and, you know, make it look good, you're good, and then you never know. I'd rather have a team that you say, we have a shot, we want it at the top, whatever. It could be probably 6 or 8 teams. You're like, we have a shot. Or be bad. Not that you want to be bad, but, you know, like last year, the way our guys played, we thought this year our core would hold the fort, and it hasn't worked. You know, that being said, you get 1 or 2 key injuries, it does change your team now. Yeah.
There's a great saying about that. If you're going to miss heaven, don't miss it by 2 inches. Yeah, there's exactly. A reward on top, and there's a reward on the bottom. In the middle,
I don't know if I'd call
not so much. You did mention your core fans, and I'm really curious about that. How do you super serve that core that will not leave? Those loyal fans, win, lose, they are there. How do you super serve that group of people when the team's taken a downturn? What do you do with them?
Communicate. I mean, I don't think you can lie to your fans and people. You got to be as straightforward as can be. I mean, there's things you can't say, but you got to be as straightforward and communicate with them. We have not really communicated with them this year. I mean, we're still figuring out a bunch of different things in an organization, but we know it's important that they understand the direction of where the organization is going. So that's another thing we talked about. Dean was very upfront with our fans. I mean, it's kind of funny that no one caught on, but for years he'd have, like, we call in the GM breakfast, and he'd literally put the lineup. He had these holes everywhere, like in boxes, and he'd be like, "Yeah, we don't have a guy there." Meanwhile, we had a team. I'm like, no one wrote it from the. I'm always shocked. He'd say, "Yeah, I don't have a guy there." There was a player. He's just saying, "If I want to win, I'm gonna have to fill up that box." And so our fans, they're like, "Oh yeah, when we get those boxes, we're gonna win." it was kind of fun.
My last question for you, Luke, is, you know, we're coming up on 35 years since you've been drafted. And one of the things that I remember, I started as a reporter. I left school. My first year as a reporter was the 93-94 NHL season. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, the Kings are coming to town. You know, there's all these stars on the team. And it was a bit intimidating for a young guy like myself. And one of the reporters said to me, talk to Robitaille. He's an easygoing guy, and he'll be good. But the one thing, you know, and you've seen it through this interview, and I think anybody who's followed your career, you've always been, no matter what's happened, you've always smiled, you've always been a positive guy. Your wife's Dasha always like that, and like whenever we see her, I remember the Score did a big piece on her career years ago, okay. Always smiling, always positive. It's not easy in the public always to be like that. How have you maintained a good attitude?
I always look at things in a positive way, and I can give you like a simple example. I remember people ask me as a player, my thinking was, if someone writes something bad about me, like, well, he's not playing well or something, then my thinking was, well, I'm going to prove him wrong. And then if someone writes something good, I'm going to prove him right. And kind of live my life, I think, this way. Like, I feel I'm very fortunate that I'm doing something that I love so much. I was a kid playing hockey. I'm still involved in the game. And I don't take it for granted, though. I don't forget where I come from. So I know I'm lucky. I think that's why I'm lucky. People have always seen me as this happy-go-lucky guy, but I don't think they saw how hard I worked to get there. I mean, I worked hard. I mean, I was a slow skater. I was 39 years old doing power skating lessons. How stupid was that? I thought I was going to get better. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't take it for granted. I wish I would have known when I was 34, because then I would have worked out better when I was 22, because we didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. But everything I did to me was to get ready for the next game. Guys used to laugh. They go, "Well, I didn't work hard in practice today." And it's true, but in my mind, it was like, I'm not really strong like the other guys, so I can't go too hard today because I got a game tomorrow. That was really what I was thinking. Like, I'd go to bed early. Like, I, you know, and like people would say, "Do you regret it?" I said, "No." And they said, "Why?" I said, "Because I squeezed a lemon. There was no drop left." And I said, "I never played an NHL game guilty." And how many guys can say that? I never went out the night before a game, ever. Wow. I mean, it was hard for me to go to dinner with Wayne because the dinners would last at 11, 11:30, and he was my idol. And I'd be like, "Gosh, I got to be in bed by 10. And then I literally had to make it an effort to say, "I can't go to dinner with him," because, you know, he'd go home like, with the guys at 11, and I had to be in bed by 10. That was my thing, you know. It was crazy.
Well, you know, it's an amazing story.
That is. And my last one, and this is selfish. I've always wanted to ask you about this. And as much as we focus, Luke, on NHL career, on the ice, off the ice, 94 World Championships, special one. Canada going for his first gold in 33 years. You score on Jarmo Milos, and Bill Ranford makes that save. Take us back to that time and that feeling, A, when you score the goal, and then when Ranford makes that save.
The whole tournament, we had such a good team. It was fun because I remember we sat out, we said, let's, you know, everybody went there before that for years and years and kind of, I don't think they were happy to go, so guys would have fun. And we said, let's have fun, but let's make sure we're focused the night before the game in the game. And then we had Kelly Buckberger and Mark Bergeron was there. Shanny came. We had a really good team, Paul Kariya. But the guys were focused on the game, so we played well. But when we got to the finals, what happened is I had studied Mario for a couple years on his breakaways. And I had seen him in junior, but never really paid attention. And somehow I'd seen that, I think, when he won the cup, and I'd seen him on a few breakaways. And Mario had this thing where he had a big reach. He was right-handed. And as he would come to the goalie, if you watch him, he'd start leaning this way, but the puck was there.
Yeah.
And at the last second, for some unknown reason, the goalie would always drop his glove. Most of the time, he would flip it up. But if the goalie would kind of lean this way, because they knew he was doing that, he would bring it quickly on his back, and he had the big reach and put it in. I mean, goalies weren't butterfly. Like, they weren't as good. But I'm like, I remember picking that up. I'm like, huh. It's like he has two options, but you cannot stop both. So I started practicing that that entire year in 93, 94. We'd do breakaways after. And every time my guy was left-handed, most goalies are like this. So instead of going high because the blocker is there, I went about this far off the ice. That was my first option. Second option was always look 5-0, because if the goalie, and then my third option, if the goalie would lead, I'd bring it back in. So it worked. Like, it worked that whole year. So when I got to the penalty shots, if you remember, it's five shots.
Five, yeah.
So when we would practice, George Kingston was our coach, and he went to the goalie. He says, if we have a shootout, who's the best? And they said, Luke, because I had my set, and the goalies couldn't really stop me because it was a three set. So George came to me, and I was the captain of the team. He says, well, if we ever go in a shootout before the tournament, he goes, which position would you like to shoot? I go, well, last, because the last will make a difference. He goes, well, actually, I'd like you to shoot first. I go, really? I go, why? He goes, because first, he goes, guys tell me you're the best, and if you score, we're going to be up 1-0. It puts pressure on you. I'm like, all right. So what happened is we go into the – we never went to shootout until the last game in the finals, and – so he tells me go first, and so I go first, and I do exactly what I knew. I knew what to do. I come in, I'm prepared, and he was a smaller goalie, so I started leaning a little bit, and he gave me the stick side, and I just put it stick side.
Scores! Luke Robitaille. Lucky Luke just walked right into the slot. He was trying to get Milos to make his move. Milos didn't make a move.
So I go back to the bench, and second guy was Joe Sakic, and he scores.
Luke Robitaille has scored for Canada. Here comes Sakic. scores!
Ooh, some NHL sharpshooters, used to playing under lots of pressure, are showing their best right now. Watch, Joe Sakic's got his head up all the way. Once again, Mills didn't really commit himself. He went down a bit in that crouch.
So they missed the first two. Third guy for us was Paul Kariya.
A goal here will end it. This is a replay of the Olympics where Canada scored on its first two shots against Sweden. Here comes Paul Kariya. Miller stopped him again.
He misses, and I remember Paul was all sad. He was 18. He had missed in the Olympics that year. I'm like, it's all right, Paul. We're up to nothing. We're going to win. It was going, meanwhile, they go and they score. So now I think we missed. I think Pat Verbeek was our next shooter. He missed. And their last two shooter was Jari Kurri and Mikko Mäkelä. Jari scored, Mikko Mäkelä scored. So now it was 2-2.
Scores!
Well, Mäkelä just picked that one perfectly.
So I got my helmet undone. I'm talking to Paulie. We're okay. I think I'm done. And George comes in. He goes, Luke, you got to go back. I'm like, what? And that at that time, I was super nervous. I remember feeling this intensity. But what happened is there was confusion where I think they didn't know who was needed to start. And I was a captain, so they had to talk to me. So it took a few minutes where I had to go talk to the referee, come back to the coach. And that during that time, I got the calm way down.
And even the coaches are confused. They're gesturing back and forth between the benches and discussing things. That doesn't happen every day.
Well, I think what they were trying to figure out, who was shooting first. And it's Luke Robitaille who was shooting first.
Luke Robitaille shooting on Jarmo Miloš. Robitaille scored the last time.
So then I come way down, and I'm like, by the time it was me, I'm like, all right, I was right back to the way I was early. I think if I would have gone early, I would have been sooner. So I was way down, and it's kind of funny to see that scene because guys laugh, because I was one of the first guys to really go slow. Mm-hmm. I knew Mario didn't go fast, you know, like but he was on a breakaway, but he didn't skate a lot. So I purposely would go slow because I knew the goalie, they weren't used to that, and no one did shoot out in those days. So I went fast, and I actually almost lost a puck, if you go back and look at it. And the minute I got close and I looked a stick side, I had beaten him there. So he leaned this way. The minute he leaned this way, I took it to the back end and put it in. I won my third option.
And he scores this time. Robitaille.
He went to the backhand. It looked as though he was going to try to pick the short side.
And then the Ranford save?
The Ranford save, I remember, I was so happy they didn't go with Jari Kurri. They didn't pick Jari Kurri or Mikko Mäkelä. They picked their first shooter to go.
Mika Nieminen, number 40, will shoot for Finland. He must score, or Canada wins it.
And Billy just was a net, and he kind of just knew Billy was going to win. He's such a pressure goalie. He went in, and the guy, I think he tried to go on a stick side, and Billy stopped it.
Awesome.
It was
moment.
Awesome.
Awesome now. Moment. Now.
Thanks so much. Appreciate
all right.
It.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right, boys.
Week.
Great to see you. To love see what you guys too. Do for our game.
Unbelievable for this game to be settled in this fantastic shootout. As nerve-wracking as it was, this is unbelievable. Luke Robitaille scoring for Canada, and Billy Ranford did his job.
Canada's goal scored by Luke Robitaille.
One Thoughts, the podcast, is brought to you by the GMC Terrain. With cargo space that fits the entire family's hockey bags and available all-wheel drive to keep them safe on icy roads, the GMC Terrain is a compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. GMC Terrain, we are professional grade. And there he is, the candid, friendly, smiling, even though we took, I'm sure, more time than Luke Robitaille was prepared for, Elliot. Luke Robitaille, I don't know that I've ever had a bad conversation with him or had a conversation where I came away feeling worse. And that continues. Felt pretty good after that one. You spoke to Luke Robitaille a number of different times. What's your main takeaway from that conversation?
So many. There's so much to talk about there. I love the story about him thinking that Rogi Vachon was taking him one round earlier at
Great
the draft.
Story.
He wasn't sure if he was saying Luke or Luck.
Yeah. And he said his first name and then, oh, no, and then changed it. Reminds me of a famous story with someone that I know.
If I just sit there in the eighth round and I watch that happen in front of me, I'd really pissed.
By the way, as a baller move, I know one person in our industry who, when he does contracts, will negotiate right until the very, very end. And what he'll do is he'll sign his first name to the contract and then put his pen down and negotiate some more. It's a great.
I would say get lost.
Great, great move. Anyway, I thought of that one.
At that point, I would say get lost.
The Rogie Vachon move. So that's a great takeaway. I mean, I love draft stories and getting down to the floor and there's no one at the table and he gets a pen instead of a hat or a jersey. And I liked his line about, listen, the minute I got picked, I was on a list. I was there, yes. And then it was up to me, which is a lesson for, you know, anybody who, well, not just players that, you know, end up going late. Oh, I'm a fifth round pick. I'm a sixth round pick. I'm a seventh round. I only have seven rounds now in the NHL. But even for people that, you know, get identified and they find themselves on, you know, NHL central scouting list, they find themselves on Sam Cosentino's list at sportsnet.ca or wherever, you're going to be on a list somewhere. And really, it's all up to you. At that point, so many guys now, the league is feathered with people that have never been drafted or were low when it came to draft day. And they were drafted on the Saturday, not the Friday.
I love the stuff about his own uniform or his equipment.
Yeah.
So then he knows that he's got a chance to make the team. They're actually beginning to take him seriously. I agree with you on that. And he's obviously a guy that proved a lot to himself and to other people. Lying about the power play. I have heard that story before, but I love listening to it. The thing in Detroit I was really interested in about team culture, I'm a big believer in culture, and people saying to him, no, we'll take care of this. You just worry about winning the cup. Scotty Bowman saying at that practice, I don't want you to get hurt now because we're going to be playing late until June. You put that every day, that has to be a thing. It's part of your process.
Yeah.
I also have a friend who will love this podcast because ever since Marlee Matlin appeared on that episode of Seinfeld where they used her to read lips, he's been in love with Marlee Matlin, so he'll love the story about her. But the thing that stands to me the most is, look, everybody gets their BS in life. Nobody gets through life unscathed. Everybody has their challenges. Everybody has their days that go bad. But you have a choice. You can live optimistically or you can live pessimistically. I don't have a lot of time for the latter. The way you should live is, hey, I'm going to make the best of everything I'm in as much as you possibly can. And he obviously has that attitude. I really like that.
As Carlos Castaneda once said, we either make ourselves miserable or we make ourselves strong. The amount of work is the same. Choose it. And I'm with you. That's Luke Robitaille. And to your point about lying to get on the power play, I remember early in my career, Bob Mackowitz Sr., when he's a PD at the Fan, once told me, here's the only way you're going to get ahead. When people say, can you do it? Always say yes, and then figure out how to do it once you've got the spot.
It's great advice. Ghostbusters.
That.
Next time, if someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
And that's it. That's our conversation with Luke Robitaille. I really hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Luke for stopping by and spending, well, man, he parked close to an hour with us. So very generous with his time, the president of the Los Angeles Kings. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Emil Delich. And thanks to Ryan Walsh as well for helping to coordinate that interview. We're back in a couple of days. More 31 Thoughts, the podcast.